So I'm filling in for Daniel as the cloakroom chair. He's out of town today. So welcome to the first Templeton Foundation's Templeton Frontiers colloquium. Our speaker will be one of PI's inaugural Templeton Frontiers postdocs talking about massive gravity. A little bit of background about Kurt Hinterbickler. He got his PhD in 2009 from Columbia. And then did a postdoc at the University of Pennsylvania for 3 years and has just started here at PI. As a side note, by way of background, I wanted to say that he also, it's worth going to his website. So he has, among other things that I recommend to you, he has written a three-voice fugue for solo upright bass, which he performs himself on his website. I highly recommend that. He also wrote a piece featuring for piano and page turner, which features a solo by the page turner. It's all good stuff. So I recommend that. And without further ado, I also wanted to mention that there has been real progress in massive gravity over the past couple of years, which he'll be talking about. And I also just wanted to mention that in case he doesn't say it, the canonical article, if you want a route into the subject, is Kurt's own review of modern physics from a year ago. So you should look that up if you're interested. And want a good introduction. Okay, Kurt.
Is this good volume? Okay, thanks for the introduction. So yeah, the first part of this talk, I'll review general relativity, the accelerating universe, the cosmological constant problem. And then I'll talk about this recent progress in the theory of massive gravity and leave it to you to decide whether it has anything to say about the cosmological constant problem. Okay, so general relativity is our currently accepted theory of gravity. It's a dynamical system where the dynamical variable is the space-time metric, g mu nu, and it's described by the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is just the Ricci curvature and then the coupling, minimal coupling to the matter fields given by psi. And then we take the Euler-Lagrange equations, and this gives us the famous Einstein equations, which encapsulates John Wheeler's famous statement that space-time curvature, which is on the left-hand side here, tells the matter, the energy momentum tensor, on the right-hand side how to move, how to behave, and then conversely, the matter tells the space-time how to curve. So this is 10 second-order partial differential equations that you solve for the metric, but they're highly redundant, and the redundancy is diffeomorphism invariance, that you're free to make a transformation, an active change in the metric by something that looks like a general coordinate transformation. And this will leave the equations and the action invariant. So it tells you that the general solution to the system has arbitrary functions in there, which are redundancies that aren't describing actual physical degrees of freedom, not actual parts of the phase space. So at its core, GR, at least around flat space, you should think of as an interacting theory of massless spin two particles. So if we take the theory and we expand it around a flat eta mu nu of uncurved space-time, and we parameterize the deviations by fluctuations h mu nu, and then expand the action to lowest quadratic order in these fluctuations, this is what you get, which is an action which describes the propagation of gravity waves. And then the diffeomorphism invariance at lowest order looks like this, a gauge symmetry given by four arbitrary gauge functions, c mu. And one way of eliminating this gauge redundancy, one choice of gauge leaves you with the physical degrees of freedom, which can be encoded in the spatial part of the fluctuations, hij, which are transverse and traceless. So if you count, there's two independent components here. And if you study how they behave under rotations, you see that it's two states of a massless helicity two particle. And it's massless because it obeys massless wave equation. And these are the true physical degrees of freedom in the theory. And then on top of this, GR gives you a specific set of nonlinear interaction terms, which tell you how this interacts, and the interactions are fixed by the diffeomorphism symmetry. Okay, so GR is a well-tested theory. In fact, I'd say it's the first theory that we've come up with that we know describes nature and yet has absolutely no practical application whatsoever. First true theory. Yeah, everyone always cites the GPS as a practical application, and it's true that if we didn't incorporate the corrections of GR, you would have, the GPS would be off by 20 meters or whatever it is. But in actuality, so we know engineers are not too bright, but if they built their GPS system and they saw that it was always off by 20 meters, they would just move it over by 20 meters. They would just come up with some post-Newtonian parameterization or something like that, and they would fit the parameters and everything would work with no understanding of the space-time curvature or the metric or anything like that. So the system could have been built and working without any knowledge of VR, I would say. It would be the first. They'd be seeing the first post-Newtonian correction of GR, but they'd have no. They could do it without any understanding of what it is. Yeah, you could say all of science is that, but this gives you additional things. Like, they wouldn't be able to tell what the next order correction is, whereas if you have GR, you can calculate that. Okay, but the theory nevertheless has been well tested in the solar system, and we can test in the solar system. Basically, because we think we know what the stress energy of the solar system is, we go out and we see the sun and the planets, and we think that's basically all there is as far as the mass energy in the solar system. So then we can calculate the metric, and we can use that metric to predict how test particles like satellites will move, and we can go to see how they actually move and test GR in this way. So here's sort of a summary of some of the tests that have been done in the solar system and also in other solar systems. Here are a bunch of parameters, which are basically just ways you can think of deviating from general relativity. So general relativity is the place where all these parameters are zero. So you can see the experimental limits are all very close to zero. GR is a very good fit. And here's another great success of general relativity, the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. This is a binary pulsar system, which is orbiting, and the orbit is decaying due to emission of gravitational radiation. And you can calculate from GR what the rate of decay of this orbit should be from emitting gravitational radiation. That's the solid line. And then the dots are the measured decay rate of the orbit over many decades. And there's excellent agreement. It's important to keep in mind also that these are all essentially tests of the linearized theory. Maybe some of these things are proportional to the leading, sensitive to the leading non-linearities. But for the most part, these are tests of the linear regime of the theory. There's no direct test of GR in the regime in which nonlinearities are very important. So now, when we go on to apply this to cosmology, we're extrapolating into this nonlinear regime. So we take the Einstein equations and we try to apply them to the whole universe at once. So we assume that the spatial sections of our universe are homogeneous and isotropic. So we're assuming the Copernican principle that our place in space is not special. And in addition, we're assuming that no direction you look in is special. And this leads us to this FRW ansatz for the metric. This is the metric that's compatible with these postulates. It reduces the 10 components just to one function of time, the scale factor A of t, which tells you how much the spatial sections are expanding as a function of time. And then the energy momentum tensor is parameterized completely by its energy density and pressure as a function of time. So you plug this ansatz into Einstein's equations, and you get the famous Friedman equations, which tell you how the rate of change of the scale factor, the Hubble constant, is proportional to the energy density in the universe. And then you get the continuity equation, which is just the statement that energy momentum is conserved. So there's several logical possibilities for using this equation. If you can independently measure the geometry, the space-time geometry A of t, the scale factor as a function of time, and you can independently measure what the matter content is, then you can do a test of GR. You can test whether this equation is true. Or you can assume general relativity, and if you measure the geometry, then this allows you to calculate what the matter is. Or you can assume general relativity, and if you measure the matter by counting galaxies or whatever, then you can calculate what the geometry should be. Okay, so let's see how far we can get with the first possibility. So measuring the geometry, this is essentially what the supernova observations do. So if you have a standard candle like a supernova, something whose intrinsic luminosity you know, you go and look at it in the sky and you can see how bright it appears to be, and then you define this quantity, the luminosity distance, which is just comes from the flat space intuition. If you in just ordinary Newtonian flat space, if you know how bright something is and you're standing some distance away, the light has to go out a sphere of radius 4 pi d squared, and this is the distance you would infer from this, from the brightness measurements. So we use this definition, we use this as a definition still, even in the presence of the curved background. And if you use now the curved spacetime and calculate what this luminosity distance will be, this is the expression you get. This tells you the observed luminosity distance you would get as a function of the redshift, z, which you can think of as a proxy for the scale factor. It's just the difference in the scale factor at the time light was emitted versus the scale factor now when we observe the light. So knowing this function, the luminosity distance as a function of z, is equivalent, it's directly measurable because you can measure the redshift directly. You just look at how the spectral lines of the quasar are shifted, and you measure the luminosity distance because you think you know what the intrinsic luminosity is, and you observe the flux. So you directly measure this function v of z, and knowing this is equivalent to knowing the scale factor as a function of time. You can differentiate this and then solve for the scale factor. So it's a direct measure of the geometry of the universe without assuming anything about general relativity or the dynamics. If you expand this function for small z, for small redshifts, you get the leading order term is Hubble's law, that the distance you infer is just proportional to the redshift. And then there's higher order corrections as z starts to become larger. And the higher order corrections involve things like the acceleration of the universe and higher time derivatives of the scale factor. Okay, so the problem is, if we use this as a test for GR, suppose we count the matter by just looking at all the galaxies and adding them up and all the dark matter and everything, including that in Team UNU. And here we put the observed expansion history from the supernova. It fails as a test of GR. The two are not equal. Of course, you can make any equation equal by adding the right thing. And the right thing you have to add is this cosmological constant, a term proportional to the metric G mu nu. So you can add it to the right-hand side and call it mysterious dark energy. You can add it to the left-hand side and call it modified gravity. But you have an additional term in the Lagrangian that you have to add to make this work as a test of GR. So here's some of the actual supernova data. So here, this plot, which is often shown, this is literally just a plot of that luminosity distance as a function of redshift. So you see small redshifts here. It's linear. This is the Hubble's law. And then as you start to get larger redshifts of order 1, it starts to deviate a little bit from the Hubble's law. So this bottom plot is a plot of the deviation from Hubble's law. And the data clearly shows that there's some deviation just from this linear relation, that there's some non-trivial acceleration. So if you parameterize this by this cosmological constant, you add the constant to make GR work again. The constant you have to add is shown in this plot, and it's clearly non-zero, making up about 70% of the energy density of the universe. So the bottom line is the data shows us that to be compatible with GR, you have to add a component of the stress energy density, which is of the same order as the matter density today. And its equation of state is -1. It doesn't dilute as it expands. Okay, so we actually expect contributions like this. There are many expected contributions to the cosmological constant. So one is anytime you have a phase transition, like the electroweak phase transition or the QCD phase transition in the early universe, your phase transition is generally going to be described by there's going to be some order parameter with an effective potential that's something like this. And during the phase transition, it goes from a symmetric phase to an asymmetric phase at lower energy. And the difference in energy is going to appear as a contribution to the cosmological constant like this. And all the phase transitions that we know of in the standard model that may have taken place, the contribution that you get here is much larger than the value that we need to put into Einstein's equations to make it work. There's also quantum contributions to the vacuum energy, vacuum zero point energy, that if we trust the rules of effective field theory, in the regime in which they've been tested, we know should be there. So if you're working around flat space, a cosmological constant is just root g. Linear order, it looks like it's linear in the metric perturbation. So the types of diagrams that contribute are tadpoles diagrams like this, Feynman diagrams. And you compute what this should be. It's an effective field theory because we don't know what the true theory of quantum gravity is, so we put a cutoff in there at the energies at which we stop trusting the theory, and you find that the quantum contribution here is sensitive to the cutoff. It's quadratically divergent and gives you a contribution like this. So if you trust the standard model, if we think that this is the true theory all the way up to the Planck scale where we know it has to break down by then, you get a value that's many orders of 120 orders of magnitude too big. Even if you think there's something at the electroweak scale where we stop really knowing about what the effective field theory should be and trust it only up to there, we know that this contribution should be way too big as well. So this is a contribution that we know should be there. There's also contribution that can come from high energy stuff that we don't know about. This would be encapsulated in the effective theory as a bare cosmological constant. It's just a constant that can appear in the Lagrangian. This is sort of like stuff we're ignorant about. And we know that the total observed cosmological constant should then be the sum of all these contributions. So the cosmological constant problem is just the problem that the answer that we know we have to put into Einstein's equations to make the data agree is much smaller than any of those individual contributions. So once we have a cosmological constant in the problem, if you're talking only about gravity, the natural scale is the Planck scale. And now that you have a cosmological constant, there's a dimensionless number in the problem, which is this famous 10 to the minus 122. So there's different aspects to this problem. The first is the existence of this small number of in the first place. This violates Tehuft's criteria of naturalness, that if you have a natural effective field theory, something that comes generically, then the parameters that appear in that effective Lagrangian, the dimensionless parameters should be of order one, and this clearly is not of order one. But the other problem is the stability under quantum corrections. So this observed cosmological constant is the sum of the quantum corrections we know should be there from physics we understand, and parts that we don't understand, Planck scale or whatever. And all of these contributions are much larger than the observed value, so there has to be a fine cancellation. And any mechanism that you can dream up to affect that cancellation has to know about quantum physics in order to do it. Said another way, so there's the old cosmological constant problem. Before this discovery of the acceleration of the universe, there was still the problem of why the cosmological constant seems to be zero, why these large contributions that should be there aren't actually gravitating or curving the universe. But now we have the new cosmological constant problem, that not only is there the problem of why the large contribution doesn't do anything, but why is there this small leftover contribution that's affecting the acceleration of the universe, and why is it similar to the matter density today? Okay, so there's several possibilities for the solution of this, if you think it's a problem. The one is, of course, the anthropic solution, which many string theorists are driven to just because it's such a hard problem. This seems like the only way out. So the idea, briefly, is just that maybe the cosmological constant is not a fundamental parameter in the theory, but it varies among different solutions of the theory, and there could be many other universes all with various values of the cosmological constant, and we just seem to be in one which is small because the small one is one which is compatible with life as we know it, and the others are not. And Steven Weinberg actually gave an argument a long time ago before the discovery of the acceleration of the universe for why the cosmological constant should be about the size that we observe today, just on anthropic considerations. And it's basically because if the acceleration of the universe is too large and positive, the universe accelerates too fast and galaxies can't form. Whereas if the cosmological constant is too large and negative, the universe recollapses before any galaxies can form. So it has to be between these two values in order for galaxies to form and have life as we know it. So there is an anthropic reason for why this should be selected. So an example of a quantity which we know is anthropically selected is the distance from the Earth to the Sun. Back before the discovery of Newton's laws, people tried to calculate the distance from the Earth to the Sun with like Platonic solids and Bode's law and all these crazy schemes. But we know now that this distance is nowhere to be found in the fundamental laws of motion governing the solar system in Newton's laws of gravity and motion. But rather, there's just many, many solar systems, and they all have varying different distances between their planets and their sun. And we're in a distance which is just right for life, just because that's the only place life could have evolved. So another possibility, which I'm going to focus on when we're talking about massive gravity, is modified dynamics, or additional degrees of freedom. Maybe there's some dynamical mechanism that drives you to a small value. So one slightly facetious, but I think still apt example of this is, say you have a ferromagnet. So we know there's a critical temperature, and if you're above this critical temperature, the spins of the magnet are all just going all over the place. There's really nothing interesting going on. If you're much below the critical temperature, there's also nothing interesting going on. All the spins are just aligned, not really doing anything. But if you're right near that critical temperature, then you start to get interesting long correlations that are on scales much larger than the scales of the individual spins. So if you see a magnet in a room which is at this critical temperature, the right conclusion for why it's tuned to this critical temperature is that there's an experimenter in the other room turning the dials and making the critical temperature just right so that he can study this interesting point. So if you include in your Lagrangian the degrees of freedom of this experimenter, it becomes clear why it's like that. Okay, another logical possibility, of course, is that it's sheer luck. There's just no explanation for why it's small. It's just that way. That's a consistent thing. So an example of this in our universe is if you look at the diameter that the moon subtends in the sky, is about the same as the diameter that the sun subtends in the sky. There's a nice fine tuning there, which gives us beautiful total solar eclipses every now and then. And it's just complete accident. There's no anthropic reason for this. Life would evolve just fine without total solar eclipses. It's just a sheer accident. Of course, here the level of tuning is like a percent or two, where a cosmological constant, it's 10 to the minus 122, so it's a little bit different question. And then, of course, there's always the possibility that we just are fundamentally misunderstanding something about effective field theory, and that these calculations and estimates we do for what the size of the constant should be are just wrong. And that there's nothing else. It's just once you fix the calculation and understand properly effective field theory, maybe it just works out. Okay, so we're going to focus on the possibility of modified dynamics. What can it say anything about this? So there's been many attempts to modify gravity to try to explain the cosmological constant. So here's a picture I stole from Claudia Durham and Andrew Tolley, where they put write down some of the many models people have thought of to modify gravity. And they range from the well-motivated and interesting to the completely crazy. There's no way that could be right. But any proposed, if you want your theory to say anything about the cosmological constant, it really has to address two broad things. It has to say, does the universe seem to be accelerating at the small rate that it's accelerating? Can it account for the acceleration of the universe with that small value? And is that small value protected from quantum correction? And second, why does the large cosmological constant that we know should be there from quantum corrections to the CC itself, why does that not gravitate? Why is that not curving the universe much more? Is there some reason why that shouldn't be there? So we also know that the modification should be an infrared modification, because it has to say something about this cosmological constant, but it shouldn't mess up those nice solar system tests of GR. It needs to revert to GR at the level, but the length scales of the solar system and below. We also know that GR is essentially the unique theory of an interacting massless helicity 2 field. So if you're going to modify GR, it means to change the degrees of freedom. Yes? Yes, of course. That's true. That's right, yeah, I'm assuming, yeah, a starting point. But it's true even around the other maximally symmetric spaces. Okay, so here's a historical example of modified gravity versus dark energy. So back in the mid-1800s, so Newtonian gravity was the accepted theory of the solar system, and the latest planet to be discovered was Uranus, and there was a discrepancy in its orbit. It wasn't following the Newtonian predictions. So Le Verrier postulated that this discrepancy in the orbit was due to a new planet orbiting even farther from the sun, and he calculated where would this new planet have to be in order to affect the deviations in the orbit that they saw. And he made a prediction for where the planet should be, and they went and looked, and there it was. So he became famous as the guy who discovered a planet with the tip of his pen. So later, the same century, it became apparent that Mercury had a discrepancy in its orbit. Its perihelion, the ellipse of its orbit, was rotating at a rate of 43 arc seconds per century. And so he tried to repeat his success of Neptune, and he postulated that there was a new planet, and he predicted where it should be in order to affect this precession, and he predicted that it should be closer, there should be a new planet, Vulcan, that's orbiting between Mercury and the Sun. And so he made predictions. Many people went out and looked for the planet, and there were many sightings of the planet, but every time there was a sighting, no one else could seem to re-sight it, and it eventually became clear that there wasn't really anything there. But he never gave up on this. He always, to the end, thought that there was a planet there. But then, in the 20th century, it became clear that there was no planet there, and then GR came, and a modification of gravity, general relativity, came along and explained why the orbit is doing this. Sorry? Sure, yeah, different equation of state. Mm-hmm. Sure, okay. Okay, so when we're modifying gravity, we don't want to do crazy things immediately. So what is the most conservative possible modification you could imagine that might have something to say about the cosmological constant problem? So to start with, let's demand that we preserve Lorentz invariance. If you mess with Lorentz invariance, you open up a whole other can of worms that we don't want to deal with just yet. So demanding Lorentz invariance, we know that the degrees of freedom are classified by their mass and the spin. So a massive particle is classified by its spin. So a spin zero particle has one degree of freedom. Spin zero has one degree of freedom. A spin one particle has 3 degrees of freedom, depending on the spin z direction, can be either -1, 0, or 1. Spin 2 particle is going to have 5 degrees of freedom, and so on. Massless particles, on the other hand, are classified just by their helicity. So helicity 0, again, has 1 degree of freedom, but all the higher helicities, there's always 2 degrees of freedom, a right-handed and a left-handed helicity. So now, of course, assuming locality, there are some theorems about what is possible, especially for these massless theories. So for a spin zero massless particle, there's essentially no constraints on the possible interactions you can have. You can basically write down anything and it's going to be consistent. For a massless spin one particle, on the other hand, there's severe constraints. And in fact, a Yang-Mills theory is essentially the only thing you can write down at low energy. For massless helicity two, general relativity is the only thing you can write down at low energies that's consistent. So in that sense, GR is a determined theory. Even if Einstein hadn't come around, GR probably would have been rediscovered in the 60s or the 70s just by these sorts of arguments, by asking what is the possible consistent theory of a massless spin 2 particle. For higher spin, on the other hand, you can't do anything. There's no consistent interactions that survive at low energy, so they can't mediate any sort of long-range force. So now for the massive guys, we want to ask similar questions. So for spin zero, again, there's no constraints. You can write any potential for a scalar field, and it's perfectly consistent, at least classically. For the higher spins, this is what we want to ask. Is there a possible consistent massive interacting spin two theory? And this should really be your first thought when you ask what kind of modification can you do to say something about the acceleration of the universe. So a massive particle, a massive degree of freedom, is going to obey a massive wave equation, the Klein-Gordon equation, as opposed to the massless wave equation. So the potential it mediates is going to be a Yukawa potential, like this. It's going to have the 1 over r Coulomb form at distances r much less than the Compton wavelength 1 over m of the massive particle, but at distances larger than this Compton wavelength, there's an exponential suppression of the potential. So you might say, if you make this mass proportional to the size of the universe today, you make it roughly the size of the Hubble constant today, that the force of gravity is going to be dropping off on these large scales, and maybe that's why the universe is accelerating. Something that's the rough heuristic that goes into this attempt. So when you do this, you're adding degrees of freedom because you know that the mass of spin 2 is going to have 5 states as opposed to the 2 helicity states of the massless graviton. Okay, so there's other motivations. Even if you don't care about the cosmological constant problem, this is an interesting theory to consider. It's just as a field theoretic question, is it possible to have a consistent interacting theory of a massive spin 2 particle? The analogous question for massless spin 2 leads you to GR. Is there a massive GR? It also gives you lessons about GR. Anytime you mess with something as nice and tightly constrained as general relativity, you learn something about it. So we'll see that the theory of a massive graviton is not quite, it's not as well behaved as GR. It's not as nice as an effective field theory. And it gives you a real appreciation for GR when you do this. But on the other hand, you can also think of it as a deformation of GR. So adding a mass term, you're deforming general relativity. So as you take that deformation to zero, you should recover general relativity. So any pathologies that you should introduce should cure themselves as you take the mass to zero. So you should discover new mechanisms for curing any sort of pathologies by doing this. And we'll see that at work as well in the massive graviton. Okay, so let's start just with the linearized theory. This is the Fierce-Pauli Lagrangian, which describes a massive spin 2 particle. So h mu nu is a symmetric tensor, which is going to carry the massive spin 2. And this action was written down already in 1939. And it's essentially unique. Any other action that you write down that describes only a massive spin 2 is equivalent to this. So the kinetic part, the two derivative part, is the same as linearized gravity. This is what you would get by expanding out the Einstein-Hilbert action. And it has the same gauge invariance as linearized gravity. But then there's this mass term. And this mass term breaks the gauge invariance. So this theory doesn't have gauge invariance in the way it's written here. And this breaking is what's responsible for now allowing these extra degrees of freedom to propagate. And there's a tuning here between the two possible contractions that you could write for the tensor. There's a relative coefficient of -1, which is important. This is the Fierce-Pauli tuning. If you don't have this, then there's going to be a sixth degree of freedom that you don't want. And then we imagine that it couples to the trace of the stress, or it couples to T mu nu, in the same way that gravity does with Planck's strength. So if you look at the equations of motion, you can recast them as this system. So there's a massive evolution equation. And then there's also a 5 constraint equations on those 10 components. So there's 5 actual propagating degrees of freedom, which are the 5 states of the massive graviton. Okay, so the first thing to do is to look at linearized solutions around sources, like the solution around the sun, for instance. So this is the amplitude for 2 conserved sources to interact, which tells you about the Newtonian potential. And the crucial difference is this factor of 1/3 here that appears in the massive theory, whereas in GR, this would be 1/2. So there's an order 1 difference in the tensor structure here. And in terms of the Newtonian potential, that translates into an extra enhancement, a factor of 4/3 in front of the Newtonian potential. And then you also get this Yukawa suppression. So you get the expected 1 over... the Yukawa fall off at distances much larger than 1 over m. But even at distances much less than 1 over m, where it looks just like a Coulomb field, you have an additional enhancement of the strength of the Newtonian interaction compared to the massless theory. If you look at other observable, like the bending of light, for instance, you find that the prediction is the same as it is for GR. So there's an order 1 difference in the physical predictions of this theory as compared to GR. So this is manifestly ruled out by solar system data. And also violates our intuition that a physical theory should be continuous in its predictions, that any parameter that you measure, you shouldn't be able to tell that by some finite measurement that a parameter is just very small or mathematically zero, whereas in this, you'd be able to do it. Okay, but any realistic theory is going to have some nonlinearities. So as a first pass at what the nonlinearities could be, let's imagine that the theory is, the nonlinear part is exactly like general relativity, just the Einstein-Hilbert term. And then we just throw on top this Fierce-Pauli mass term. So this is a brutal violation of diffeomorphism invariance, because now we have explicitly this flat metric that appears here in the Lagrangian. So this is not going to be the best, not going to be the way ultimately to do this, but as an illustration, it shows the effects of nonlinearities. So we can, again, we can ask for the Newtonian potential, and we can expand it in powers of the nonlinearities. So at leading order, we get the Newtonian, we get the form that we had in the linear theory, and then we get some corrections. And you can ask, when do those corrections start to become important? And they become important when the radius is larger than, smaller than this radius called RV, which is called the Weinstein radius, and it's this combination of the parameters. So this is a radius which sits at a distance much smaller than this 1 over m where the Yukawa suppression kicks in, but it's a distance much larger than the Schwarzschild radius where the nonlinearities of general relativity would kick in. So this theory becomes nonlinear more quickly than general relativity does. Also, this Weinstein radius, it goes to infinity as the mass goes to zero. So as you try to recover the limit of GR, this Weinstein radius goes out to infinity and the whole thing just becomes nonlinear. You can't trust the linearized theory in that limit. So the conjecture is that this discontinuity is cured by the nonlinearities. If you take into account all the nonlinearities, you'll restore a smooth GR limit, and it will be consistent with solar system tests. And you'll see explicitly how this works later when I show you the more proper massive theory. So another traditional problem with a massive graviton is this Boulware desert ghost. And this is just the statement that this nonlinear theory, as I've written it, has more degrees of freedom nonlinearly than it does at linear level. So to ask what the full number of degrees of freedom are, we should do an ADM analysis, a Hamiltonian analysis of the full nonlinear theory. So when you do this for GR, this is what you get. You break up your metric into lapse and shift and spatial metric, and you see that the lapse and the shift appear as Lagrange multipliers in the Hamiltonian. So they enforce constraints which generate the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory and reduce the degrees of freedom. If you do this for the massive theory, you get now that the lapse and the shift are no longer Lagrange multipliers. They now appear quadratically. So they appear as auxiliary variables. So they can be eliminated by their own equations of motion. They don't enforce constraints on any of the other variables. So now the spatial metric, which had six components, and formed a six-dimensional real space, a 12-dimensional phase space describing 6 degrees of freedom, there's no constraints anymore, so they're all dynamical. So you have, in fact, 6 degrees of freedom in this theory at nonlinear level, whereas you know that the mass of graviton should only have 5 degrees of freedom. So this extra degree of freedom that you don't want is known as the Boulware desert ghost, and you can show it's a ghost because this Hamiltonian is, in fact, unbounded from below, so it's just an unstable system. That's right, diff invariance is gone. It doesn't mess up anything about global Lorentz invariance. There's still a global symmetry of Lorentz invariance. But the local Lorentz invariance, I mean, that local Lorentz invariance is essentially a gauge symmetry as well. It's not, there's, you're, that's right, yeah, that those kinds of things are going to be different. But again, we're going to try to argue that this recovers GR in a certain, when the, as the mass is, at least for solar system scale. Okay, so now there's a better way to see how these things work and to analyze this theory, which is to work in terms of variables that more properly encapsulate the actual helicity content or the physical degrees of freedom of the theory. So we do this replacement where we take the metric and we replace it by this combination where we've introduced a new vector field and a new scalar field. So essentially all we're doing now is making explicit the ultra-relativistic limit. So if you have a spin 2 particle with its 5 helicity states and you highly boost it, you know that those 5 helicity states are going to break up into 2 helicity plus and minus 2 states, 2 helicity plus and minus 1 states, and then a helicity 0 state. So we're just repackaging those states into these different fields. So if you look at the linear theory now, and you look at this massless limit, and you canonically normalize everything, this is how it looks. we get something that looks like the massless, the Einstein-Hilbert massless spin 2 Lagrangian, then a Maxwell-like term governing the helicity plus and minus 1, and then a kinetic coupling between H and the helicity 0 mode. And you can diagonalize this coupling, this mixing here, by doing a conformal transformation of the metric, and then you really get just a theory of a free massless spin 2, a free massless spin 1, and a free massless spin 0. But by doing this diagonalization, you've introduced a coupling between the helicity 0 mode and the trace of the stress tensor. And it's this coupling which is responsible for the VDVZ discontinuity. Essentially, the longitudinal degree of freedom here is a fifth force that's acting to enhance the Newtonian potential between static objects. That's why there was this additional enhancement of 4/3 due to this attraction. But it didn't mess with the light bending because the trace of the stress tensor for light is 0. Yes. Yeah, so we've done the Stuckelberg trick here of reintroducing the gauge invariance that's been broken by the mass term. So by doing this replacement now, there's now a fake gauge invariance where A mu nu shifts like a Maxwell with a Maxwell-like gauge symmetry, and then phi shifts to compensate for it. Right. Okay, so let's go back and reconsider these interaction terms now. So before we just had this, we just stuck the Fierz-Pauli term in, and it was we didn't think too hard about it, and it led to problems. So let's try to be more open-minded and general and write the most general possible potential you could write for the graviton, the most general possible term without derivative. So here it is. So we've ordered it. These things are just all possible traces and various contractions of the field H mu nu. So at linear order, we have this Fierz-Pauli tuning, but then at higher orders, we've just written every possible contraction with an arbitrary coefficient. This is the most general term you can write. Right, so we're saying that the derivative structure is the same as Einstein-Hilbert, but the potential can be arbitrary. Okay, so now we do this replacement again, and now because of the interaction terms, we get all sorts of interactions between all these various helicity components. Here's sort of the general type of term that you could be expected to get. And all these terms are non-renormalizable. It's a non-renormalizable theory. And there's various mass scales suppressing these non-renormalizable terms. So you should ask, what is the lowest such mass scale that appears? And that's going to be the cutoff of this as an effective field theory. And you find that the lowest mass scale that appears is the scale lambda 5, which is this geometric combination of the Planck mass and the graviton mass. And the worst offending terms are these scalar self-interactions of the scalar field. So the picture is this. It's a consistent effective field theory in the sense that you've got a cutoff, lambda 5, which is parametrically larger than the mass of the graviton. But it's not as good as general relativity because the cutoff is still much below the Planck scale. These scalar self-interactions, you can show, are responsible for the Weinstein radius. You can ask, at what radius around a source do these scalar self-interactions start to become comparable to the linear terms? And that radius is precisely the Weinstein radius. So these terms are responsible for the strong coupling of the theory, for the nonlinearities of the theory. And it's also responsible for the Wohlwehr desert ghost, because these are higher derivative terms, which will have fourth order equations of motion. And that's essentially the reason classically for the appearance of this ghost. So a key insight in this whole thing is that you can, in fact, eliminate these terms by choosing very carefully the interaction terms, which you can show to do order by order in H. You can arrange for all these scalar self-couplings to vanish into total derivative combination. So just by choosing the right potential, you can eliminate these worst offending terms. Once you do this, the leading nonlinearities now are no longer scalar self-interactions, but rather interactions between the metric and the scalars, things like this. And you find that the cutoff now has been raised to a higher scale, lambda 3, which is this different geometric combination, which is parametrically higher than the old cutoff, lambda 5. So you've improved the quality of the theory as an effective field theory. Now you look again at the leading interaction terms. Here's what they look like explicitly in terms of the actual tensor structure and everything. So these x's are various functions of the scalar field, which I'll show you in a second. And these parameters, C3 and D5, it turns out there's a two-parameter family of ways to affect this cancellation of the scalar self-interaction. So there's a two-parameter family of nice theories, and these are the two parameters. These X tensors are these various special, these fancy combinations of the second derivatives of the scalar, but they have some nice properties. One is that they're identically conserved, as demanded by the linearized gauge invariants that we've reintroduced in this Stückelberg trick. And the structure of time derivatives on these things is just such that there's no longer any ghost. The equations of motion here are purely second order. You have no additional degrees of freedom. So you've eliminated the Bulwer-Desert ghost from the theory, at least in this limit, just by tuning these interactions away. So you asked for the cutoff to be higher, but as a byproduct, the ghost has been eliminated. Yeah. Yeah, we started by building it around a flat background. That's right, yeah, it's only a massive graviton. That's right. Okay, let's look more closely at these scalar interactions. So you can diagonalize the metric decouple the metric and the scalar, and what you get is a theory that has scalar self-interactions that look something like this. So the terms that appear here are rather complicated derivative self-interaction terms. They're called Galileans. And these terms have nice, very interesting properties in and of themselves. They were actually discovered before all this massive gravity business, but they appear naturally in this massive gravity. And these terms have some interesting properties. So their equations of motion are purely second order, even though the Lagrangian is higher order. There's no way to eliminate the higher order in the Lagrangian, the higher order derivatives in the Lagrangians just by integrating by parts or anything like that. But the equations of motion, all the higher derivatives magically cancel out, and it's a second order equation. So there's no extra degrees of freedom being propagated. There are West-Zumino terms for this type of extended shift symmetry. And they have this property of non-renormalization, that they receive no quantum corrections at any loop. So what you see classically is what you get quantum mechanically. So, both, yeah. So it's Lorentz invariant, so everything cancels. They're just second order even with respect to any of the derivatives. Because they're not there. It's a purely second order equation. You only need two pieces of initial data. No. Because they're not there. It's a second order differential equation. You need two pieces of initial data to get a unique solution. Even in other brackets, they're just nonlinear, they're just not there yet. Okay, so let me say a bit about how these terms are responsible for the recovery of GR and the screening of this fifth force that you naively expect from this extra scalar. So let's focus on just the simplest of these Galilean terms, which looks like this. So we've got the linear part, we've got the Galilean part, and we've got this coupling to the trace of the stress tensor of matter that we saw before is responsible for the VDVZ discontinuity. So let's ask for the solution now around the source, such as the sun. There's two regimes at distances r, which are much larger than this Weinstein radius, which is the distance at which the nonlinearity starts to become important. At distances larger than this, the nonlinearities are unimportant, and it's only the kinetic term that's doing anything. So you get the 1 over r Coulomb potential, and you get a fifth force. But at distances much smaller than the Weinstein radius, you get this funny r to the 1/2 behavior for the potential. So if you ask now, what is the size of the fifth force with respect compared to the force of gravity? It's order 1 at these large distances, but it's suppressed by this factor r over r Weinstein to the 3/2 when the Weinstein radius, when you're at distances much smaller than the Weinstein radius. So Another way to see this screening is imagine we expand in small fluctuations around the spherical solution, around the sun. So the fluctuation Lagrangian now looks like this. It has a kinetic term which gets a contribution from expanding this derivative term. And if you ask what is the size of this additional contribution to the kinetic term, it goes like R Weinstein over R. So at distances much less than the Weinstein radius, this term is becoming very large. So after canonical normalization of the fluctuation, the coupling to matter is becoming very small. So it's effectively just decoupling itself. The nonlinearities are causing the scalar field to decouple itself from matter, and you don't see this at fifth force. This is known as a screening mechanism, the Weinstein mechanism, and it appears naturally. This is how the theory recovers continuity with GR. So here's the summary of this better behaved massive gravity theory. So there's this Weinstein radius, distance is larger than this, it's linear, and it doesn't agree with GR, there's this fifth force. There's this cutoff, 1 over lambda 3, a distance is smaller than the cutoff, you don't have anything to say about the theory, the effective field theory breaks down. But there's this whole parametrically large intermediate regime, which includes the solar system and all the interesting things we might like to do to test this theory. And in this regime, it's completely nonlinear. It recovers general relativity, and it's under control quantum mechanically. And even it's better than that because there's, in fact, no quantum corrections for these Galilean-like terms. What you see classically is exactly what you get. You can also prove that, so this was all in this specific massless limit known as the decoupling limit, but you can show that the absence of this Boulware desert ghost, in fact, proceeds to all orders. The complete theory is free of this ghost. No. Yeah, I'll get to that. Okay, so the theory can in fact be completely resummed. So order by order, we argued that we could choose these coefficients to do things, to make this nice theory. And then it turns out you can resum, in fact, the entire theory with this choice. So here's what the massive theory of, here's what massive general relativity looks like. The mass term has this funny square root structure, and these S's are characteristic polynomials, which are things you get just when you expand the determinant of a matrix. And so you have the inverse metric here, but then you also explicitly have the flat metric appearing here, which is what breaks the diffeomorphism invariant. And then these betas, there's in fact two independent betas, which are the free parameters that went in that you had a choice of. A nicer way to formulate the theory, in my opinion, is in the Feuerbein formulation. This square root that appeared should make you think that a Feuerbein formulation is the way to go. And in fact, you can do that. So you introduce a tetrad for the metric. And now the mass term looks like this. The various possible mass terms are just all possible ways of wedging the dynamical tetrad with a background unit tetrad. So these, you could think of these as like bimetric generalizations of the cosmological constant. And to go back to the question, this remains ghost-free even if you make this second dynamical metric something other than Minkowski. You can make it any metric that you like. In fact, you can make it a bimetric theory and add other metrics and do all sorts of things and retain this ghost-free property. To get it into the tetrad form, you're just... the previous one? There wasn't any field redefinition. This field... So H before was the fluctuation of the metric. We've just repackaged that as the full metric. Yeah, this is just a resummation of all those terms, all those powers of H that we wrote down earlier. Well, there were no... Right, so I went back... Yeah, that's right. So what I showed you before was in this Stuckelberg approach where you introduce explicitly the longitudinal mode and the scalar mode. So in this, yeah, here I'm showing you the theory back in its original variables where all you had was H and you've fixed all that redundant gauge symmetry that you put in to show the helicity components. Okay, so just some broad features of this theory. So theoretically, it's interesting because it's the first really a consistent ghost-free effective field theory that propagates just a single massive graviton. So it answers the question of what a massive version of general relativity is. So now with respect to the CC problem and those two things that any consistent modification should address. It should explain why the universe is accelerating. And in fact, this theory has self-accelerating solutions. So even if you set the bare cosmological constant to zero in the theory, there are solutions where the acceleration happens, and the scale of acceleration is set by the mass of the graviton. And this acceleration is technically natural now. You're not going to get large quantum corrections to the acceleration because a small mass breaks the diffeomorphism symmetry. So as you take the mass to zero, you've recovered a symmetry. So all the quantum corrections and things now have to be proportional to the mass. So you've made this small value technically natural. The harder problem it has to address, of course, is why a large cosmological constant that's generated from the other matter that we know is in the Standard Model, why that should not curve the universe much more than just the acceleration that's caused by the self-accelerating solution. And this is a harder problem which requires invoking some sort of screening mechanism, which this massive gravity theory at the linear level, in fact, has. If you take the linear theory and you put in a large constant source for the energy momentum tensor that's proportional to the metric, you'll find that Minkowski space is still a solution. So in that sense, that the linear theory can screen a cosmological constant. Whether the full nonlinear theory can do this or not is very much an open question and subject to debate. So so that remains work in progress. And then it naturally possesses this Weinstein mechanism that hides the additional fifth force that you would naively expect from adding new degrees of freedom. So I'm going to have to... Okay, so there's one sort of hidden surprise in all this. Yeah, essentially. That's right, yeah. Yeah, there would be. Because this mass term completely breaks all the difference invariances. There's still boost invariance. There's still global Lorentz symmetry. Because you have this background metric that sits there explicitly is the Minkowski metric in this simplest way of doing it. So yeah, globally there's still boost invariance. So I take it back. There wouldn't be a preferred time slicing. You'd still have the boost invariances of special relativity at large distance. Well, local Lorentz symmetry is a gauge symmetry. Like when you talk about local rotations of frame, that's not. Mm-hmm. Right. That has full diff invariance. Yeah. If you could also make this a bimetric theory if you like. Yes, so you can make it a full bimetric theory where then it now has full diffeomorphism invariance, where both metrics transform the same way under diff symmetry. So this would be a theory now that propagates, in addition to a massive graviton, also a massless graviton. That's right. Okay, so let me say briefly about this issue of superluminality. So this Lagrangian we wrote down for this longitudinal mode, this higher derivative Lagrangian, possesses a strange feature, which is that around some solutions it exhibits superluminal propagation. So let's take that radial solution around the sun again and expand in fluctuations. Here's the quadratic action for fluctuations schematically. And you can ask what is the speed of radial propagation of the fluctuations and angular propagation. And if you look at the speed for the radial propagations, you find that it's greater than light. So if you think that this theory can be UV completed in sort of a simple Lorentz invariant way, you're going to run into trouble. Because we know that any UV complete proper Lorentz invariant quantum field theory, we have that operators commute outside of the light cone and that this is a background independent statement. So around any background, you shouldn't have this type of superluminality. So this suggests that any UV completion of this theory is not going to be a standard Lorentz invariant local QFT as we know it. It's going to be something different. In particular, it's not going to be a string theory. In fact, this, if there were experimental evidence that showed that the graviton were massive, that would rule out string theory, because as far as I understand, in every string background, there's always a massless graviton. So this really going in this direction is really doing something different. Okay, so in summary, this particular theory of massive gravity with this better behaved choice of terms and everything is really the best behaved IR modification of gravity there is. This is as good as it gets as far as modified gravity. This 40-year-old problem of the Bolaire Desert Ghost has been solved. It naturally incorporates these Galilean theories, these scalar degrees of these scalar theories, which I could say a lot more about. Just in of themselves, they're very interesting theories. Very strange that they even exist at all. There are some new signals for cosmology, which I didn't have time to get into. And there's still some sort of underlying topological structure, the fact that in the sphere-bind formulation, these are like generalized Lovelock, bimetric Lovelock terms of some sort. But so it remains to be understood what the sort of underlying geometric structure of this type of massive theory is. And then there's still the issue of UV completion. It's not a UV complete theory, and there's signs that the UV completion is going to be unlike anything we're familiar with just from local Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Okay, so before anyone leaves, and before we take questions, if you haven't signed the sign-in sheets that were going around, if you could please do so, we'd be very grateful. I know that people pass around sign-in sheets, and I myself am guilty of never having signed one. But it's complete hypocrisy for me to ask you to do so. But anyway, if you could do it, that would be great, because the Templeton Foundation has kindly provided funding for Kurt's postdoc and for colloquiums like these, and the one thing they ask is that we sign them to let them know how many people arrived. By the way, did they run out of space, or does anyone need more? I have more. No? No, they didn't run out of space because you guys didn't sign them, probably. Or hopefully. Okay, so anyway, questions. John.
You spontaneously violate the symmetry, right?
Yeah.
You start with massless particles. You spontaneously violate, you get this theory is renormalizable, da 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 da. So if you start with a massless GR, you can spontaneously violate with a Mexican hat potential in Fierpine formalism. And then you would get a theory which is well behaved.
Good, yeah.
So you're starting, the Stueckelberg formalism starts with putting in the masses by hand,
which
breaks the gauge invariance.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, so nobody knows how to do what you're describing.
I published this 20 years ago.
Wow, okay. But,
okay, so it's possible to do this.
But whether, we can talk about that. But yeah, so this is, as you said, this is analogous to just putting in by hand the masses for the W bosons in the standard model without knowledge of what the Higgs mechanism is that UV completes that.
You see, in the standard model, the Stueckelberg theory can get you into trouble.
Right.
Because of the scalar degree of freedom. You have to start hiding it, okay?
Yeah.
And so why are not people doing what I'm saying?
Okay. So I don't think it works. But so the naive, if you try to play the same game, what you play. So in the standard model, suppose you didn't know about the Higgs mechanism, and you tried to play the game of, we start with what we see, the massive W bosons, and we try to UV complete that. We ask what possible additional particle could you have that would make the amplitudes unitary, and then you see that there has to be this additional Higgs particle, and it has to be, you can basically discover the Higgs mechanism by doing this. If you try to play the same game here, so you ask what is the additional particle I have to put in to unitarize the amplitudes of the massive graviton, you find that the additional particle you have to put in is a ghost. So in fact, it leads you to one of these ghost theories as opposed to this well-behaved.
The Higgs mechanism is a negative mu squared. It's a tachyon mechanism.
Yeah, but at the level of the physical degrees of freedom and what's going on, it's a way of it's unitarizing the amplitude. So let's talk about it.
So I can see that this is very interesting from the point of view of field theory, but from the point of view of the original problem of the cosmological constant, what exactly have you gained? So there's a fine tuning.
Right.
I mean, you have to choose a very small value for the mass of the graviton.
That's right.
Because
that's
you left out lambda, but you could have equally well chosen the vanilla so-called theory in which you would choose surprisingly small value for lambda, and everything so far would work.
That's right. So you haven't. So any modified theory you think of is not going to explain the small number of the acceleration, I don't think. The small number has to come from somewhere. But what you hope to gain is that small number is now technically natural under radiative correction. But if you set it to be small classically, it will stay small after the quantum correction. So if the acceleration can be explained in this way, that's what you've gained. That the small mass in this theory, that small number, stays small under quantum correction.
But why is lambda so small?
Right. So then on top of that, you also have to explain why lambda doesn't degravitate, or why there's some mechanism that degravitates lambda. So you explain the acceleration with the mass of the graviton, and then you have some mechanism to explain why the large lambda that you know should be there doesn't actually curve the universe.
So do you think that this technical naturality is actually a persuasive condition?
Sure,
I mean,
yeah,
what is its status as a physical principle?
Yeah, I mean, if you have technical naturalness, then you can imagine that there's some mechanism that you can think of classically that sets your value to be small, and then it stays small. So small neutrino masses, for instance, people don't worry so much about them because they're technically natural. They're protected by chiral symmetry. So if you have something like a seesaw mechanism that you think up that makes them small, then it will stay that way even after you compute the quantum correction.
So your hope is that because it's technically natural, this sort of screening mechanism has a higher chance of working? Is that another way of saying it?
I don't think so. I think the screening mechanism and the technical naturalness of the acceleration are different concepts. You need both to solve the cosmological constant.
Well, okay. I'm not sure I understand the subtle distinction between an arbitrarily chosen very small number that's technically natural and an arbitrarily chosen very small number.
Yeah,
it's not technically natural.
Well, why don't we worry about small neutrino masses? That's the distinction.
Well, I thought you did want to understand them.
Well, no, yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk.
So I guess I have sort of empirical questions and formal. So empirically, what's the best bound on the Weinstein radius? And the binary pulsar still supposed to, as I understood it, basically says that the energy leakage is due to spin two modes, and those are very tight constraints. So could you comment on that? And on the other hand, it still seems to me like everything depends on eta, ultimately. You could do it about some other background, and if so, what happens?
Right. Yeah, so for the Weinstein mechanism, if you ask just what is the Weinstein radius for the sun, for instance, when does this screening start to kick in? The Weinstein mechanism radius for the sun is larger than the galaxy. So it's an extremely effective screening. You'd never really see any deviation. So binary pulsar, same thing. There'd be very small corrections, but the scalar mode, basically, the extra mode just doesn't couple to the pulsar, so you wouldn't get any leakage of extra gravitational radiation. As far as expanding around different backgrounds, this is what we're going to try to do if you're going to do cosmology with this theory. So there's this absolute metric eta that appears in the Lagrangian, but then we're going to be searching for cosmological solutions that are different, that are you know, FRW, or self-accelerating or whatever. So then there's two sort of backgrounds in that theory, then, but the absolute metric, this eta, and then whatever background cosmology. Yeah, so that's what these self-accelerating solutions are, just pure de Sitter solutions. Well, the solution itself is de Sitter, but that eta still appears in the Lagrangian. It's just that eta is not the metric that matter will then couple to, because matter, you imagine, is minimally coupled to the full metric. There's no eta explicitly sitting in the matter coupling. Yeah. That's right, yeah. If the topology was inconsistent with the background, that's right.
Yeah.
Sorry? It's comparable to the Hubble constant, in fact.
From the biometric point of view, because you implied there is a story which starts with a purely diffeomorphism invariant biometric theory. Such theories generically have 8 degrees of freedom.
Right.
And basically your story is a story about how the 8th degree of freedom, which is normally a ghost, got killed.
Right.
Is there a beautiful way to tell that story in which there's an extra gauge symmetry or an extra symmetry which kills that 8th degree of freedom, or is it just a fine-tuning issue?
I don't think so. I mean, the answer is nobody knows, but it doesn't seem like it. So the extra constraints that eliminate this degrees of freedom, they look purely like second-class constraints. They don't have any associated gauge symmetry to them. So I don't think so. I think it's just second-class constraints that are doing it.
Is there at least a principle? I mean, the way that you told the story, right. there's a large number of terms, and there's a delicate cancellation between the contribution to this ghost to all these terms. It seems like it's crying out for a more elegant way to understand why
I
that
agree.
Happens.
Yes, I would love for there to be a more elegant way. I think it's going to have to do something, some sort of bimetric Lovelock terms need to be invented to describe this. Some sort of characteristic classes that involve more than one metric is what these terms seem to be. But I don't know what that is.
Although I would add, I mean, you had this, you resummed and then you wrote it in terms of Fairbairns, and then it did end up looking very elegant. But I mean, it did, so there were several terms you had to add and they could have arbitrary coefficients.
Yeah.
It just had to appear in this, each of the terms had to have this form that there were anti-symmetric contractions of that. Mm-hmm.
That's right, yeah. So those are sort of going to be like the lowest order bimetric Lovelock term.
That's right. They just have to appear in those combinations.
Just a question about this. I think it's the question of Rob Mann. That is, there seems to be two point of view you're having. One is, it's a theory about, let's say, spin too massive. But then the question is that, well, then there's not one theory. There's as many as choice of backgrounds. Maybe you can choose eta, or what Rob wants to take, constant curvature, or another one.
Yeah.
Or then, but if that's the point of view, then there's the question which is crying out, which is, okay, what select this background metric to be flat or constantly curved? So people, and I think it's the same question if you take the biometric point of view. Now the guy becomes dynamical. So now there's the question about this extra degrees of freedom. What's, you know, why, I mean, you know, what choose these guys to be flat or cosmological? Or?
Well, yeah, I think you could ask the same question of GR. You could think of GR as the self-interaction of a massless spin 2, so that starts as a construction around Minkowski space, but then you build up the theory, the interaction terms, you resum them, and you see that there's other solutions of the theory. So.
But then there's an answer. At least in asymptotically flat space, you have a well-defined notion of energy, which is positive, and flat space-time is the, you know, is the only solution that, you know, equate the energy to zero.
Right, but then you're dismissing all the things like De Sitter space and cosmological solutions because they don't have the asymptotics of flat space.
Yeah, I'm saying, but at least in flat space. So it means clearly in, you know, if you untie De Sitter, then the vacuous solution has a different structure. So there's a question about asymptotic structure.
Yeah, so I think you'd say the same thing in this theory.
Is there?
Can you show... Different asymptotic structures would be like different sectors of a theory with...
But could you show, is there a positivity energy theorem that, for instance, forces this background to be flat on asymptotically flat?
Yeah, there isn't. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good. Okay, that's a good question. Yeah. I don't think so. No. Yeah.
In relation to your slide about the possible solutions to the problem early on, with entropics, etc., the slide earlier about the solutions to the cosmological concept, well, the possible proposed solutions, entropic, uh-huh. Etc.
Oh, yeah.
I remember reading an article about another possible solution, and it seemed very common sense. I was wondering what your opinion would be about it. And it's basically, it says that. Well, in general, if you have a theory with a certain parameter that you don't know, and you don't have any prior information, just as in the case of GR with the Big Bang, yeah. You don't know how it started, then it's intuitive to assume, well, we take a constant constant probability. Well, we have no information, so we use principle indifference, everything is equally likely, and that makes the super small value around the zero weird. But the article goes to say that view is too naive, and that, for example, your probability distribution that has no prior information based on it should, for example, also have the symmetries of the laws of physics. For example, it should have the symmetries of, I think it says that A, the constant we're interested, the A of T, should, for example, if you multiply it by a constant independent of time, that it shouldn't matter. And for example, that the probability distribution should have that same symmetry. And if you would use a reasoning like that, that you would actually get a different probability distribution, where omega can expect it to be one.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, isn't that saying, in a sense, that there's an anthropic, you're saying that lambda is not a parameter of the theory, but you want to say, actually, there's many such places where lambda can vary, so there's some probability distribution, and that's going towards the anthropic direction.
No, it's not anthropic. It's just
maybe it's not relying on the existence of life or anything, mm-hmm. but it's saying that there's a multitude of possibilities, and
basically it's just saying that if you have no prior information, mm-hmm. that it's too naive to just think that the uniform probability distribution is the okay. most common one.
But even to say that, you have to admit that there's more than one possibility for the graviton, which means going beyond GR. I mean, that's like saying that there's more than one possibility is saying that it's not a fundamental parameter, really, that it's being chosen from a distribution. So there's other incarnations of the same theory or universe. Well, no. So strictly speaking, no, because this degravitation mechanism hasn't been shown to work completely non-linearly. That's what needs to happen.
All right. Well, maybe that's a good point to stop. Thanks to Kurt again.